Sparkle Stories and Dry Gables Hands Together. Whatever power I have. Greetings, friends. My name is John Bernard Bauer, and this is the story about my hometown, Dry Gables, South Dakota, and the brave, wise, adventurous, humorous, and deeply loving people who founded it. It's a remarkable place, Dry Gables. From my great uncle Johann's forge to Liesel Hertz's clinic to Lena and Franz Denken's dry goods store. The town itself is really a character in every one of these stories, quietly encouraging each of its citizens to strive to be their best selves and to help each other, not only in times of need, but every day of the year. My town and all her people are dear to me. They are a part of me. And maybe, as you listen to the stories, they will become a part of you as well. Now, in fair warning, the story I have to tell is, well, something of a heartbreaker. It's about my great uncle Johann, but it is also about Dry Gables, about South Dakota, and it is about this wonderful country, the United States of America. We often hear stories about America as the city on the hill chosen by God, or the great melting pot, stories of the American dream and the promise of our country. But the stories about our failures, those chapters are not as well known, but they still must be told. Now, before I go too much further, I want to be clear that when I say this story is about heartbreak, I mean that it is also a love story, as you can't have heartbreak without true love. That's a given. It is the risk of love. Every shadow must have light and vice versa. So just like this American experiment of ours is a story of contradictions, of opposites, of difficult to pin down chapters of our common experience, and for most of us, our personal experience. I learned this story when my great uncle was a very old man. I was no longer living in Dry Gables, being then a published author living in New York City of all places. I came back to Dry Gables as often as I could, and when I did, I used to spend a great deal of time with my great-uncle Johann. His mustache was bright white by then, and his eyes were gray. And the mighty shoulders I had always depended on were then much thinner and resigned. He was an old man, full of stories, but no longer able or interested, really, in swinging the blacksmith hammer that always seemed to be in his hand. The mighty founder of Dry Gables was now its elder storyteller, and his precious hammer had been passed on to his assistant George Striking Hand, a young Lakota man who had been working with Uncle Johann for many years. Now, I did not know George Striking Hand very well, but I knew I liked him. He was quiet, he was strong and kind, much like Johann, come to think of it. He was a good man, and though no one could ever fill my great uncle's shoes, George Striking Hand made a fine blacksmith and a good friend to the people of Dry Gables. So, sitting on his back porch, looking out and up to the Black Hills to the north, he told me a story that truly surprised me, because though Uncle Johann was a private man and not one to talk much about himself, I thought I did know him. At least, the most important people and events in his life. But what I heard proved that wrong. So, to properly set the scene for this tale, I hope you will forgive a very brief historical summary before I get to the specifics of the story, because, well, I think it's important to understand a few things to fully appreciate what my great uncle did. The first people to inhabit the part of the United States we call South Dakota came from the north. Some say there was once a land bridge that connected Russia and Alaska, and the first people walked across that bridge and eventually found the grasslands, the buffalo, the deer, and the cool, clear waters of the rivers to be exactly what they were looking for. Sometime later, around the time the first people from Spain and Holland were showing up in the east and the south, one tribe, called the Cheyenne people, and another tribe, called the Arapaho, started jockeying for the Black Hills in the Southern Valley. There were fights between them, I am sure, but there was an agreement that the Cheyenne could hunt in these hills, and the Arapaho could hunt in those hills, and that was fine. Now, no one was saying that they owned the hills or any of the land. There were no fences or signs that said no trespassing. The Cheyenne and Arapaho felt about the land like we think about air. It's for everyone, of course it is. They just didn't want to be on the same land hunting the same deer at the same time. So they worked it out. Well, sometime later, about the time when the French and the English were traveling west from the colonies and exploring, doing some trapping and hunting and looking around, the Sioux people, which included the Lakota and Nakota and Dakota, moved into the Black Hills and pushed the Cheyenne and Arapaho further to the south and west. So, that worked out for about another 100 years until a group of Americans, because this part of the world was now called America, happened to find a hunk of gold in them thar hills, and the American government broke a promise. The promise, up until this point, was that the Sioux people could have the Black Hills. The Sioux claimed that the Black Hills were a very special, spiritual place for their people, and that was just fine with the United States government. But when that gold was found, well, they changed their mind and said, "Tell you what, we want those Black Hills, and you people can have a chunk of land to the east." Well, the Sioux and the Cheyenne and the Arapaho and many other tribes did not like this move. No, they did not. They believed it was disrespectful and dishonest, and they declared that they would fight. And they did. And they won some of the battles, but they lost the war. And that was right about the time when my great uncle Johann, my grandmother Marta, my father Wilhelm, my mother Jane, the Denkins, Seamus O'Connor, and Liesel Hertz arrived and founded my hometown, Dry Gables. I'm not sure how much they knew about the history and the state of affairs with the tribes at that time, but they certainly weren't looking to offend anyone or take something that wasn't theirs. The founders of Dry Gables made it a priority to find land that was unclaimed, where they could build a place to live, where people could be themselves and take care of each other. And it was in that environment, and during that very painful time in history, that my great uncle Johann met Iron Eyes, a Lakota Sioux brave or warrior, who was brother to a very important Lakota Sioux chief named Spotted Elk. So Iron Eyes and Spotted Elk lived to the east of Dry Gables with their families and the other members of the tribe. Many of them had moved from the Black Hills to this grassy land and had accepted their new home. but others were still very angry at the Americans for going against their word and making them move. Well, Iron Eyes, it turned out, was a little unusual. He was curious. He wanted to know how these Americans lived and worked, and he marveled at their houses and their ways of eating and dressing. And when he happened upon the original 9 founders of Dry Gables working on the lumber for the Neuenstimmen meeting house that would soon be the center of the new town, he did not object. He did not ignore. Instead, Iron Eyes asked, as one would in his native tongue of Lakota. The response of the Dry Gables folk was immediate and unfortunately common in Iron Eyes' experience. The biggest man stepped forward holding a hammer, and he was flanked by another man holding a kind of an axe, that would be my father Wilhelm, and a woman holding what looked like leather straps, my mother Jane. The big man in the center was, of course, Johann, and he was doing what he naturally did, protecting his family.
"What do you want?"
Johann bellowed at the man in his own native tongue, German. Iron Eyes assessed the situation and saw that some of the 9 were fearful, yes. Some looked defiant and brave, and some looked maybe sympathetic. Iron Eyes then tried something else. He asked them the same question, "What are you doing?" But this time he asked it in French, which a few members of his tribe spoke due to the trading they often did with the French fur traders to the north. This definitely changed things. Shoulders dropped, and the looks of fear and defiance loosened a little and became more like confusion. One of the sympathetic ones, Seamus, our future schoolteacher, stepped forward and answered, also in French, "Do you also speak English?" Iron Eyes took a breath, and then answered in perfect English,
"I do, but I don't like the language much."
Seamus and the others were relieved to hear that they now had a common language, and then Iron Eyes repeated,
"What are you doing?"
This time, in English. It was Johann who then answered,
"We are building a home for a community who wishes to live together peacefully."
Iron Eyes looked at the lumber and at the other 8 who were doing the building, and he nodded his head. And then Johann looked at Iron Eyes and asked,
"We were told that no one owned this land. Was that wrong? Is this your land?"
Iron Eyes looked at Johann and then at Seamus and at the woman with the leather straps, my mother Jane, and said,
"No, I don't own the land. And you were told correctly, no one owns this land. But your government doesn't understand that."
Johann was reassured that the land on which they chose to build was not owned by anyone, but he was confused by the Lakota man's words about the government. Before he could ask a question, however, the man first asked,
"You say live peacefully. Tell me, what peace is to you?"
Johann and Iron Eyes looked at each other for a while before Johann answered,
"To live in peace is to live respecting those around you, who they are. It is taking care of each other and offering our gifts and strengths to the community so that all may live well together."
Iron Eyes narrowed his gaze for a moment and then said, "And what of those who threaten that peace, of those who wish to take what you have?"
"As I said, we take care of each other," answered Johann.
And all who were there could see that some kind of understanding was built in that moment between the 2 men, a kind of understanding that was the foundation
of what would become a very close friendship. Iron Eyes left that day wishing the Founders well and inviting them east to visit him and his family. "You can meet your neighbors," he said with a smile. And it was agreed. A few weeks later, once the roof was on the meeting house, a small team consisting of Johan, Liesel, and Seamus traveled to a camp near Manderson to see Iron Eyes and his family. When they arrived, they met Iron Eyes' brother, Spotted Elk, or Bigfoot, as many knew him. They met his wife, known as Mrs. Iron Eyes, and their little daughter, White Hand, who was given that name because she so often clenched her hand into a fist. Liesel connected immediately with Spotted Elk, who was the tribe's medicine man, and the two of them talked about medicinal plants in the area. Iron Eyes gave Seamus and Johan a tour and introduced them to many of the members of the tribe. Johan was uniquely taken with White Hand, as he could tell she was like him, a short temper, ready to fight. He smiled watching her resist her parents when they asked her to help with a meal or for cleaning. When Johan, Seamus, and Liesel left that day, they left having established a relationship, one built on being good neighbors, respecting each other's community and needs, and offering support when they could. And they did. For that first year, as they built the meeting house and then the clinic and the dry goods store, Iron Eyes and the others would visit, delivering herbs to Liesel or hides to the Denkins. And in return, Johan and Wilhelm would build them tools to help with farming or building, or Marta would share some of her breads, or Jane would loan out some books she had picked up in Yankton. It seemed like a bright future for their relationship until, well, tragedy came to Iron Eyes' tribe. Now, in some circles this event is controversial, but not in my circle. What happened near Wounded Knee Creek, I believe, was a tragedy of the highest order. Now, you should know that there are others who have researched this more thoroughly and have more informed opinions about the event. I am not a historian and will not claim that my account is most accurate, but this I can tell you. A regiment of American soldiers, for reasons that were unclear, gathered a group of Lakota Sioux that included Spotted Elk and Iron Eyes and brought them to a spot near Wounded Knee Creek. There apparently was a misunderstanding, and that misunderstanding resulted in a very swift and fierce battle. 25 soldiers died in that battle, as well as hundreds of Lakota, including Spotted Elk and Iron Eyes and his wife, Mrs. Iron Eyes. So, here is the heartbreak. When the news of Wounded Knee came to Dry Gables, everyone was devastated, of course, but it seemed to hit Johan particularly hard. When my mother Jane told him, he apparently went into such a rage that he nearly destroyed his own forge. His shouts could be heard throughout Dry Gables, and when he finally emerged from the wreckage that he had created on his own, he demanded that Jane give him one of the horses. "They will pay," he shouted. "They will pay for what they have done to my friends." Now, I'm not sure what Johan thought he was going to do. He had his blacksmith hammer in his hand and looked like he was ready for battle, but against an army? Against the United States government? No one could talk sense into Johan until Liesel arrived. Liesel, the town healer who had gone with him on that first trip to visit their Lakota friends. "Yes," she said to him with a similar fury in her eyes. "Yes, you are ready to fight.
You are ready to do battle for our friends, Johann, and I believe you. I believe you could show the soldiers how wrong they were. You could show them how important our friends were to us and others, and you would avenge them, Johann. I know this.
Johann nodded his head, grateful that someone understood his fury and rage and his powerful intentions. But then Liesel shifted. She came close to him. She looked him in the eyes and said,
"But I wonder if we should help the wounded first. Help those who need us now more than ever."
Well, here is where Johann's heart did two things at the very same time. His heart broke as he thought about his dear friends, Iron Eyes and Mrs. Iron Eyes. But his heart also seemed to swell twice its size when he thought of White Hand, their daughter. The competing emotions that were swirling in Johann's chest were too much. He dropped the hammer that he had been clutching the entire time. He slammed his fists on the thick wooden table in his forge, and he let out an angry, pained howl that made all the birds that perched in the trees of Dry Gables suddenly fly into the air. And then he stood still, breathing heavily, and Liesel gave him plenty of time and space, standing by his side, letting him feel whatever he was feeling. Well, tears came to Johann's fiery eyes, and then he turned and took Liesel in his arms.
"We have to go to her," he said as tears began to flow. "We have to go to White Hand. We have to help her."
"Yes," said Liesel, who
pulled back enough to look again into Johann's eyes.
"And we have to go now."
At this, Jane gave them both a horse, her fastest horses, and, well, off they went. It took a while to get there, and I'm sure that Johann was impatient to arrive, but when they did arrive at the camp in Manderson, well, it was difficult. There's much to say on this subject, the subject of what is the right thing to do, the subject of how do you properly make amends when you have done something wrong. But I do know that my great-uncle Johann did not think that the army or the American government had done the right thing, had not made amends. And so that was now up to him. He and Liesel spent the next few weeks doing what they could. Liesel nursed the injured and the grieving, while Johann focused most of his attention on White Hand's care, protecting her, making sure she and her extended family had whatever they needed. I know that he wanted to take her back to Dry Gables and raise her himself, but he also knew that this was not what was best for her. It took a great deal of convincing from Liesel, but eventually he agreed that White Hand should be raised by her cousins. It was best for her to be with her people. Johann understood this, but when it was time to leave and return to Dry Gables, well, he felt like howling again, and he wished that he had something that he could smash or throw or pound. But he did his best to contain himself as he gave little White Hand a hug. Goodbye. So, the next part of the story is what I learned from Johann so many years later. You see, as far as my friends and family of Dry Gables were concerned, that was the end of Johann's relationship to White Hand and the people of Manderson. Yes, we continued to trade and help each other out when we could, but no one knew that Johann was secretly meeting with White Hand and her family. No one knew that he was supporting them however he could, making sure that they got what they needed. and that when Johann would borrow a horse to go get supplies, he was actually going to Manderson to see Widehand. Well, he watched her grow up. He met her husband, William Whitebear, and then, when they had their first child, a son, Johann dedicated himself to the boy, pledging to always be available to him in whatever way he needed. And that boy was named George Striking Hand, the boy who would one day work with Johann and inherit the position of Dry Gables blacksmith. George Striking Hand got his name because, like his mother, he had a temper. Like his mother, he balled up his hands into fists. Only George liked to strike. As soon as he was able, George demonstrated a tendency to fight. He didn't like it when others were too close to him or too far away. He didn't like it when others were too loud or too quiet. He always seemed angry, and his parents did not know what to do with this rage. Johann, however, knew exactly what to do. "If he wants to hit something," he told them, "then let him hit iron." They resisted at first, not wanting their son to leave the Manderson area and go to a place that seemed filled with European Americans. But Johann introduced them to Mininewa, the Cheyenne town historian, and some of the other Nakota and Arapaho folk that spent time in Dry Gables. And eventually, they let George Striking Hand make the decision himself. His answer was short and to the point. "I want to learn," he said with a still face. "I want to learn to use my hands, learn how to make things, how to make new things that haven't been made, so that one day I can use what I know to help my people. And I think Johann will teach me the best way to do it." His mother and father could not argue with him. What he said made them proud, and it made a kind of sense. Johann was not one of them. He was German and white, and looked like the soldiers that had changed their life forever. But like George said, he knew how to use his hands, and they believed that he knew the best way to use his hands, to bring change. So, George Striking Hand moved to Dry Gables and became Uncle Johann's apprentice. He became an excellent blacksmith and an active member in the affairs of our town, and a few years after I heard Johann's story, George decided to leave town, because, as he explained to Johann and the others, he had learned what he needed to learn from them, how to use his hands, yes, but a lot about how to fight for the people you love and to serve who you love as well. The path he chose surprised everyone, including Johann. Well, he went to school. He enrolled in the South Dakota State College, paying his own tuition, and graduated with honors. And then he got a job at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, where he worked for many, many years, fighting for Native American rights. And then, at the young age of 45, he ran for United States Congress, and he won big. Now, Johann lived a long life and helped many people along the way. He supported, inspired, and modeled a life that I wanted to have for myself. Yes, one where I got to use my hands to make things, beautiful, useful things. But in later years, Liesel helped me see a side of Johann that inspired me to serve, to see who around me needed help, and give me the strength and determination and passion to really be helpful, to use whatever power I have for those people who need a champion. Yes, that is a good word to describe my great uncle. Champion. The champion of Dry Gables.
This has been an original story from Sparkle Stories of sparklestories.com. Copyright 2017. All rights reserved. We hope you enjoyed it.